In the heart of the Coulee region, where three rivers meet, nestles a town. Surrounding it, strong in their grandeur, protectingly, the hills look down. Extending from the valley floor back into the hills like probing fingers are the peaceful coulees with their gently sloping land, where night lingers. Between the blue-hazed bluffs, the Mississippi flows onto the sea. Oh, it is the loveliest place on this great earth for me to be.
The Wisconsin College of the Air presents A Profile of La Crosse, the final program in a recorded series entitled Wisconsin Profiles. Here's your narrator, Ray Stanley.
In the profile of La Crosse, we're using again a combination of two techniques. We're going first into history to meet some early residents to find out what they did for the community. In the second half of the program, we'll meet a few persons from the La Crosse of today. The embryo of a community is a diverse thing. It comes from many places. Part of it is ages old, ages devoid of the stark, sudden changes wrought by man. In this category lie the coulees, the rivers, and the bluffs. The bluffs now seem to stand immovable, regimenting the rivers and refusing to admit that they were carved out by the waters, which move with modest pliability, carrying with them disintegrated landscapes. These are the factors which give a community its natural beauty. These are the factors you can see and feel from the top of Granddad's Bluff, the magnificent stone sentinel which dominates everything in La Crosse. These are the factors which moved Elizabeth Wiley to write The Coulee Region, the poem which opened our program. But these were also the factors which gave La Crosse its economic potential, the magnet which attracts men.
Let's see, one horse, one cow already aboard. You ever been up there before, Mr.
Levy, John Levy? For several months, yes. Long enough to convince me it isn't as desolate a place as you seem to think.
Of course, I only go by what I see from the river. That ain't much. See some hogs. How many? Four?
Five.
Five. Company making us write stuff down nowadays. Yeah, you can only see about three shacks from the river. Only the tops of them. So much brush and stuff. One crate of chickens. What you got tied to the crate? A coon?
That's right, a coon.
Well, ain't none of my business, but he's gonna eat them chickens. Four trunks, couple of sacks. Already aboard. How many people you got?
Only my wife and son, besides myself.
Like I was saying, you can't see much from the river, except the people. I know there ain't more than, nine men, four women up there that can walk, because they all come down every time we dock. That's a laugh. They ain't got no dock, what you can call a dock. It ain't gonna be easy unloading this stuff. None of my business, mister, but what are you planning to do up there?
Oh, quite a number of things. For one, I think I may build a dock.
Build a dock? Well, now you're talking, ain't nothing they need more. You can't pull up to a rickety old pier with the boats they're building nowadays. Let's see, anything you're taking along we ain't mentioned yet?
That's all, except for two cats and a dog. That completes our family.
All right, mister. You can get aboard now if you feel like it. We'll be loaded, ready to head up inside half an hour.
These men were pioneers on the river. One remained anonymous because, from his vantage point on the steamboat, LaCrosse was just another stop. The other is included for what he did to make the river more useful to LaCrosse. It was 1845 when John Levy left Prairie du Chien to move with his family and his menagerie to a new home. History records nothing about their trip except to indicate what they brought with them, plus the fact that several of the chickens were eaten by the coon. John Levy was a product of European civilization. He was born in London and educated in Switzerland. He spoke five languages. In America, he left civilization behind and started to build a new one. His first project at LaCrosse was a frame house, the first frame house between Prairie du Chien and Red Wing, Minnesota. And soon after that came a project requiring 50,000 bunches of willow sprouts.
Yeah, that's right. 50,000, anyway, 50,000. Remember, I have built this many times before on the Rhine. I know these things. You have marked out 136 front, 160 deep, and 12 high. For this we need anyway 50,000, and they must be fat ones like this. Fat. Anyway, 100 sticks in it.
Well, I have no doubt we can find enough willows around here to make all the bundles you want, but you'll excuse me if I'm still a bit skeptical. I've never been exposed to anything like this before. How do you propose to fasten them together?
You have not noticed that when the willow branch falls to the ground and sticks to a place where there is moisture, it takes root and grows. So it will be with your dock. The grains of sand, the water, will carry them into the nooks and the crannies, and the willow shoots grow and cling themselves together.
You mean the dock will eventually be all in one piece?
Yeah. All in one with the ground that LaCrosse is itself built on.
Valentine Denninger brought to LaCrosse a dock-building technique that people on the Rhine River had been using for centuries. In the enterprising John Levy, he found a customer for his technique, and the result was LaCrosse's first steamboat dock. Mr. Levy had a great faith in the future of the river as a transportation medium. He built the town's first frame hotel to accommodate river traffic, and near his willow dock, he built the first steamboat warehouse. Most of these developments took place in the middle 50s before the railroads came, when steamboating was near its economic zenith. But steamboats prospered only because communities were growing on the riverbanks. They stopped at LaCrosse only because people there were buying things and selling. But why did the people settle there in the first place? Well, a few of the very first came to trade with the Indians, who for countless years had been gathering here to play a game the French named LaCrosse. A few came to farm on a small scale, for here was a rare stretch of prairie in a locale where tall bluffs crowd the river closely. Others, like John Levy, came for no reason obvious now, perhaps visions of future prosperity. As it did in most communities in the northern half of Wisconsin, prosperity came to LaCrosse with the sawmills. Most of the equipment unloaded on John Levy's willow dock was consigned to sawmills. The Black River joins the Mississippi at LaCrosse, and along the Black River were stands of beautiful white pine. The lumber didn't last long, but it served to settle the community, and it speeded up the development of transportation facilities. The first railroad The Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul reached La Crosse in 1858, giving the community its first overland contact with large industrial centers. The population of the town at that time was only about 1,000, and it was easy to get the tracks close to the center of town without crowding too many citizens. 26 years later, when the second railroad came to town, the population had increased by some 14,000. And the Burlington Road needed a good deal more than engineering strategy to lay tracks through the middle of town.
Come in, come in.
General Maloney, sir, reporting for duty.
What?
You are Mr. Joseph Losey, aren't you?
Yes.
Well, got 100 men, sir, waiting further orders.
Oh. I'm sorry. I'm a little slow tonight. Did they tell you to expect a fight down here?
Not exactly, but you never can tell. It just seemed a little like a military operation, sneaking the men in here like this. And I can't see no reason for that many men just to lay track, especially when you got two full crews just outside of town already.
There's plenty of track to keep them busy without time off for a fight.
Maybe so. How do we stand with the folks on 2nd Street?
On the east side, fine. On the west, we haven't gained an inch.
Edwards?
Edwards.
So we stay in the east?
Strictly.
All the stuff ready?
It's waiting for you. North crew has ties and south has rails, and they should have extra tools if you need them.
Yeah, we'll see. How about the straw bosses?
The job's all yours. You're the boss.
Do they know it?
They're ready for you. You know, of course, that you're starting tomorrow.
That's what I understood. No objections.
Good. See you in the morning. And good luck, just in case. Good morning, Frank. Don't good morning, Frank, me, you cheap shyster. You're cutting this town in half. Now tell these outlaws to stop before
I'm sorry, Mayor. I'm sorry. We're perfectly within our rights.
Oh, rights?
And remember now, you were quite eager to have the Burlington come here.
Do you call that rights to take over? Did anybody say he was eager for you to take over practically the main street of the city?
Well, I
know a half dozen men here, property owners on this very street, who have not given permission for you to go through here yet.
And they're all on the west side of the street.
All right.
You notice the tracks don't touch the west side. You notice that?
Well, what?
Well, the law says the road doesn't have to pay damages to owners on the far side. And everyone on the near side here has agreed. Perfectly in the right, and that's the law.
I can use a little law myself, Losey. Did you ever hear of an injunction?
I have.
All right, then.
But I have also heard that you can't get an injunction on Sunday, and this happens to be Sunday. Have you heard that?
Yes, and I've heard that Sunday is always followed by Monday, and on Monday I'll be here with an injunction as solid as Granddad's.
It won't do you any good because the tracks will be finished, and if you come down here Monday,
we'll be tearing those tracks.
Postscript. The road was complete through town before Sunday was ended, so there was no injunction. There was no bloodshed either, or so much as a fistfight, even between J.W. Losey, lawyer and railroad expert, and Mayor D. Frank Powell of La Crosse. Looking back on the incident from a distance of 66 years, it's difficult to find fault with either Powell or Losey. The real fault, perhaps, was in the law, which made it unnecessary for a railroad to pay damages on both sides of a street. The Burlington probably never would have tried to go through 2nd Street if it had been required to deal with property owners on both sides. As a direct result of this incident, the law was changed by the next legislature. The man instrumental in getting it changed was B.E. Edwards, one of the property owners on the west side of 2nd Street. A more positive result was a third railroad for La Crosse. When the Burlington came to town, the Northwestern decided to come also, and La Crosse found itself with incredibly good transportation for a town of less than 20,000. River traffic was fading fast in 1884 when the Burlington came to La Crosse. Trains did in a few days what took a steamboat weeks. Trade that had once made John Levy prosperous moved inland to the railroad depots. Steamboat warehouses emptied and docks decayed. Riverfront property spent depreciative summers growing miscellaneous weeds. But railroads did not alone eliminate the steamboat. The river itself assumed a new and undependable behavior. In the early days of river traffic, northern watersheds possessed an army of trees, which delayed precipitation to be rationed out to the river in quiet springs during seasons of dryness. After lumbermen removed the trees, rains fell uninhibited and went wastefully down the river on a temperamental binge. Engineers eventually made the river suitable for traffic again. And a little later, we'll talk about what the river means to La Crosse now. This is the turning point in our program. We've been talking about people from La Crosse history. Now we start talking with and about people living there today. However, we'll continue on the general topic of transportation, because this seems to be the most important aspect of La Crosse. Transportation employs only a little more than 10% of the working people in town. That's an unusually high percentage for any town. But 90% are still unaccounted for. How do they make their living? Well, most of them work in manufacturing. They make farm machinery, auto parts, rubber goods, air conditioning equipment, and dozens of other products. But La Crosse lacks many of industry's basic needs. Water power and coal are not near at hand. Neither is steel and other raw materials. Neither are the markets. The only thing that can compensate for such deficiencies is transportation, and therein lies the strength of La Crosse. When the lumber industry collapsed near the turn of the century, La Crosse already had three railroads vying for trade. Why did they happen to be there? Let's ask a railroad man.
I think the principal reason for that is our location between large centers like Chicago and the Twin Cities, and en route to the Pacific Coast. The traffic to the Pacific Northwest must necessarily go through this area because of the natural water level route we have through here along the Mississippi.
That was James Conway, a ticket agent for the Burlington. We talked with him in the Burlington's beautiful new depot at the foot of Granddad's Bluff. He mentioned a few of the materials used to build it.
The sidewalls are travertine marble, Montana travertine. They were mined there and along our right-of-way out in Montana. And the floor is terrazza. And the fireplace at the south end of the station is, the stone in there is Abilene stone. And the outside wall of the station is Lannan stone.
A ticket agent can seldom carry on a conversation with one person for 10 consecutive minutes. There's always a telephone call to divert his attention. Here's Mr. Conway's half of a telephone conversation as overheard by the microphone.
Burlington. We have nothing to arrive that early. Unless you were to go the night before. Our earliest train leaves La Crosse 4:50 in the morning and arrives Minneapolis at 9:25. And if you were to go the night before, the evening's effort 8:07, getting in at 10:45.
A moment ago, we mentioned that a little more than 10% of the working people in La Crosse are employed in transportation. Chiefly responsible for this high percentage is the Milwaukee, La Crosse's first railroad, and the Burlington, both of which maintain repair centers here. Railroad maintenance, like all other types of mechanical work, has been extensively complicated during the past few decades. A corps of electricians and diesel engineers have been added to the terminal crews to service the ever-increasing diesel-electric power units. A visit to a modern terminal brings you to a fuller realization of the upsurge in use of the diesel-electrics. A realization that may invoke a little twinge of sadness if you've been thrilled by the music of the steam locomotive and if you resent the raucous arrogance of the diesel horn.
Savannah, Oregon, Aurora, and Chicago. Chicago passengers aboard the train directly in front of the ticket office windows.
other passengers to the one car to stop at the end of the station.
The transportation business is probably gifted with a larger number of distinctive sounds than any other field of endeavor in our mechanical civilization. Here's one that's not as unmistakable as a train, but one hearing should narrow your choices down to only two. It would take an extremely mobile imagination to get anything but a truck or a bus out of that. In this case, it's a truck, operated by one of the nation's largest trucking companies, the Gateway Transfer Company, with headquarters in La Crosse. Here's Henry W. Setzer, Assistant Secretary and Treasurer of the company.
I might give you some idea of the extent of the company's operations today. We go through, we have routes extending through and into five states. Those are Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, and Missouri. We have about 17 terminals. We operate just about or close to 600 units of equipment. That you might contrast again with what M.P. Murphy started with in 1896. Yes. It was said by a writer some years ago that Mike Murphy had four mules, two horse blankets, and Earl Morgan when he started. Today, that's 800 or more employees.
Here's what that means in terms of dollars.
At the present time, the company is operating at the rate of about $6,300,000 sales per year. That's an estimate for the year 1950.
The company, as M.P. Murphy first conceived it, was purely a local cartage company, powered by four horses and two mules. In 1927, the company began what truckmen call over-the-road operation. And now you can seldom spend a half hour on the highway without seeing a Gateway truck. The airplane has a distinctive sound, too, but not distinctive enough for us. We failed to get our airlines straight and suffered a little embarrassment. Listen closely to this conversation with airlines pilot Herman Lerdahl, and you'll see what we mean.
And what's your position with United, or with Northwest?
Northwest, yeah, captain, flying captain.
How long have you been flying for Northwest?
I've been flying for Northwest 9 years this fall. In fact, it's over 9 years now. I've been in the business 23 years.
You've been flying transports that long?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just happened to go through my 13,000th hour the other, about a week ago.
For a few words about the facilities of La Crosse Airport, we talked with Frank Muth, airport manager.
It is built on an island which is formed by the Mississippi and Black Rivers, approximately 5 miles north of the business district in La Crosse. We have three runways, each 5,300 feet long, 150 feet wide, paved with asphalt. And each is lighted with contact and range lights. There are 50-foot taxi strips parallel to the runways, which are built to converge all traffic into the administration area.
During the few minutes that Herman Lerdahl's plane stood on the ramp, we noticed the loading of many bundles and boxes too bulky to be passengers' baggage. And later, Frank Muth told us about freight shipments.
La Crosse Industries have used air service, especially freight and express, to the extent that we have built up an enviable record of cargo moved by air for a city of this size.
River transportation was the first type we mentioned on this program. It's also the last, because that's exactly where it lies chronologically. It tapered down to almost nothing during the early 1900s, and now it's coming back. Here are a few of the men using river transportation in La Crosse. First, R.H. Pierce, purchasing agent of an air conditioning and heating equipment plant, the train company.
Well, I think that you'll find that river traffic at the turn of the century did wane. But I also think that you'll find it has picked up in the last few years. I've seen a tremendous amount of merchandise traffic go up and be delivered to Minneapolis or the Twin Cities. There's been a lot of coal hauled to Winona long before we ever had a terminal here.
And here's Ed Yearley, fuel distributor.
Along in 36, they completed most of the new dams on the river that brought about a 9-foot channel. And it was shortly after that that the first oil barge was moved up to Minneapolis, which they didn't think could be done. With the new channel, which allowed larger boats and larger barges, the movement of coal began on a small scale.
La Crosse's first barge load of coal went to Ed Yearley in 1945, and since then both oil and coal have been coming in steadily increasing quantities. Here's one of the main advantages of barge transportation from Ed Yearley's standpoint.
River transportation is fundamentally, I'd say, a bulk commodity type of transportation, and in being able to get large quantities of, say, coal into La Crosse, we protect ourselves against the weakness of rail transportation in the middle of winter when you get frozen cars and rail movement is slowed down because of snow and ice, which you've all seen happen. Having large quantities of coal moved in the summertime, we've got a reserve supply that protects us against bad conditions in the wintertime.
That would seem like heavy competition for the railroads, but Mr. Yearley indicates a compensating factor.
There's a lot of petroleum moves out of La Crosse on a reshipment basis, both by tank car and by transport. In our terminal across the way, we ship out a lot of it by rail, and we ship out a lot of it by transport. In fact, it all has to move out by some other means of transportation but river. We get it in by river, but from that point on, it has to move by railroad or transport.
Although a preponderance of river cargo thus far has been oil and coal, the future holds promise of more diversification. The trend may have started last fall when the train company got its first shipment of steel. Purchasing agent R.H. Pierce explains why his company finds barge transportation advantageous.
The production in our normal steel market, Chicago, is only sufficient to take care of the needs of about 50% of that which is required in this district. It is necessary, therefore, for us to go to another market in order to supply these needs. The Pittsburgh district, on the other hand, only requires about 60% of their production. Due to river traffic, we are unable to supply our needs by purchasing requirements from the Pittsburgh district, transporting by barge, and allowing us to remain competitive with steel purchased from the Chicago market.
Although river transportation is coming back, the steamboat isn't, and the gaudy gaiety of those craft will never be recaptured. There's little romanticism in the pushboats that churn the Mississippi now. They look like belligerent iron tails, wagging with calm deliberation, lifeless floating dogs. But that's the perspective one gets looking from the bank into the stream. Reverse the position and watch the shoreline. After a while, it will matter little whether you're traveling on a showboat or a rowboat. Listen as Ed Yearley describes one of his favorite vacations.
Well, we had a load of oil come into the terminal, and I knew the fellow who owned the towing company, so three of us decided we'd take a little jaunt down the river on the boat and look things over. To me, it's one of the most fascinating trips in the world. You sit there, you have nothing to do because you can't work, and but you watch the scenery go by, but I never was so relaxed in my life as just sitting there in the sun and enjoying the scenery, and I didn't have a care in the world. Business was a million miles away, and if you ever want to relax, it's about the nicest way to do it. And then, of course, every 20 miles or so, we went through a set of locks, and there's always some people around who are watching you go through, and you're right there where the thing's happening, so I'd like to do it every summer.
Even if you've never seen the Mississippi, much less traveled down its length, you may find something in Ed Yearley's recollection that swells in you the nostalgia of a reborn memory. If so, set that memory up in plain sight and say to it aloud, "Mark Twain, here's a man you'd like to meet." Perhaps it seems that the river has consumed a disproportionate amount of this program. But our purpose has been not to show the various facets of the community in their correct proportions, but to emphasize the things which make La Crosse different from other Wisconsin communities. That same purpose made the profile of La Crosse a feature story about transportation. In no community we've studied has transportation played a more important role than in La Crosse. The town's economy depended first on lumber, and transportation rose to serve it. First the river, and later the railroads. But railroads did not recede with the pine forests, as they did in so many other communities. La Crosse happened to be in a direct line between the Twin Cities and Chicago, so the trains continued to run, and their convenience attracted other industries. In recognition of La Crosse's position on one of the nation's greatest travel routes, the people there have chosen to call their city the Gateway to the Northwest.
That concludes The Profile of La Crosse. Production by Carl Schmidt and script by Les Nelson. Ray Stanley was the narrator. Music by Don Vegley. Sound effects by Myron Curry and technical assistance by Ben Russey. This has been the final program in a series entitled...